Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Historical Friction, a podcast about retelling the past and framing the present through pop culture. I am Helen Victoria Murray, a writer, researcher, and fan of culture from high to low, who you might have heard guesting alongside Alice on some previous episodes. But this episode is my first time hosting in my own right, and I am so excited because we're discussing one of my favourite films. As part of a two-parter on Robert Eggers, we will be looking at the tentacular spectacular that is The Lighthouse. You can find me on Twitter at Helen V. Murray and follow the podcast at History Friction. We are also on Patreon and we hugely appreciate any support you can give to help our podcast run. Thank you so much for listening.
Hello, it is my great pleasure today to welcome Céline Brosio. We are going to be talking about the 2019 Robert Eggers film, The Lighthouse. Céline, thank you so much for being with us today. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about what you do?
Thank you so much. So I'm very excited to be here talking about this movie with you. So I'm an assistant professor of French at Ursinus College, a small liberal arts college in the US. And I work specifically on 19th century literature, and I like to look at texts that deal with the link between solitude and madness, how overextended isolation leads characters to madness. So I've been, as of late, more interested into narratives dealing with lighthouses, because I think a lighthouse is just the perfect setting to become mad.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in the film that we are looking at today, that is an absolute leading through line through the whole piece, is this idea of isolation and solitude within the lighthouse, and something that can madden and you know, really create that sort of folie à deux madness. That being said, let's just set up for our audience a brief synopsis of The Lighthouse. So in this film, novel lighthouse keeper Ephraim Winslow, played by the gorgeous Robert Pattinson, joins the more seasoned lighthouse keeper, Wiki Thomas Wake, to keep a lighthouse on the outskirts of Maine. This is all set in the sometime in the 1890s. And the film takes place over a sort of uncertain period, a number of weeks, during which they kind of lose all track and all sense of time and almost their awareness of reality, bringing in this sort of really sinister and supernatural effect that may be a curse of the sea or may just be the product of a little bit too much gin. Have I missed anything out of that summary?
No, I think it's very good.
And I think, like, the subject of isolation and the idea of driving people mad is so crucial to this film, isn't it? Because it is this very, very tight cast. You have Robert Pattinson playing Ephraim Winslow and Willem Dafoe as Thomas Wake, and that's really the sum total of the cast. There's, you know, if you don't count a mermaid hallucination and a tentacled hallucination. In our earlier Robert Eggers episode, we talked about how the director uses a kind of the tightness of cast and the real idea of keeping the drama and dialogue very, very small. And what I think we see in this film is characters who are sort of driven mad by being alone together. They're worn down by their own relationship.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is the fact that they barely talk to each other, and they start only kind of loosening up only when alcohol is kind of involved. So it's like two solitudes together. And also the fact that they have, you know, separate shifts. So, you know, one is awake during the day, the other one is awake at night, also does not help them to develop a brotherhood or a bond until alcohol comes in, basically, later on.
Yeah, totally. I think at one point in the dialogue, Robert Pattinson's character even says, "You're barely even human anymore.
Yes.
You're tolerable only when you're drunk."
Yes.
Which is kind of funny.
Well, and you know, like, it, to me, what's very interesting is that, and in narratives that I've seen before, is this notion that those humans become machines. And it's very interesting in the movie because you hear the ticking. So it's, of course, the ticking is the time passing, but it's also these humans that are becoming machines. At one point, Pattinson just cleans something and he accelerates again and again and again and again to the sound. It becomes the sound of a train. And then in the end, they end up drinking the oil that's used for the lamp. So these humans have become just machines, but broken machines, because they don't know what to do anymore. So I found the whole drinking of the oil that is supposed to, you know, serve to make the machine work properly is derailing them completely.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I feel like when you look at this film in the kind of overarching notion of Robert Eggers' oeuvre, you have the witch, which is this very forest-based, organic, tree-based kind of lifestyle. And then you move on to this late 19th century industrial sort of oil-soaked, machine-driven thing. And I think, you know, you could put a lot of focus on the sea wildlife and the kind of oceanic imagery, which is also, of course, huge to it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, thinking about that kind of like oil-soaked mechanical idea of like what it's turning human beings into.
Yeah,
there's kind of like an ecological angle to that, and a real kind of tonal shift in terms of like the overarching work.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. The fears of the time of what the speed and the trains and the all those machines can do to human beings, I think it's there somewhere.
Yeah. And would you say that looking at the kind of like the Lighthouse novel as you've experienced it, like, is that kind of reflective of those anxieties in 19th century literature as well?
Yeah, you definitely see those fears of kind of a modernized society and what it can do to humans, who, you know, the role of machines and how they can function with your brain, you know, like this idea, like the speed of the train is going to make your brain explode. So this whole modernized world or industrialized world creates a lot of fears of what human brains can take in terms of this, all these changes. So I think there's definitely an anxiety.
One of the things that kind of happens in the film is that time stops working for the two characters. Mm-hmm. It kind of starts out that they have this very fixed and limited time period in which they're going to be staying on this island together, and they're kind of hanging in together, you know, 4 weeks. And it begins in this very regulated process, and you almost get like this slice of life. The grind is regular, the work is anticipated. One person works during the day, one person works during the night, and they sort of tolerate each other on that basis, don't they? And then there's this kind of crucial crux point that happens near the middle of the film, where the boat doesn't come, the relief isn't coming. And from that point on, time kind of becomes this really unstable thing where neither the audience nor the characters are really aware of what's going on in time.
Exactly. And I love this scene where Willem Dafoe says, "How long have we been here? 5 weeks? 3 days?" And you're watching the movie and you have no idea either, you know, because if they can't tell you how long it's been, then how are you supposed to know? So I love that the confusion of the characters is really bringing confusion to you as the viewer. You have no idea, you know, whether it's just been a couple days, but they're becoming so mad that you think it has to have been quite a while. And when in the end, a little later, Dafoe says that we've run out of food, basically. So you realize they've been here for really a long time. But you still don't know how long, really. And to the point where you know, Pattinson just punches the clock because nothing matters anymore. Time doesn't matter. It's kind of this long stretch of life. Day and night, actually, what I found interesting is at the second part of the movie, nobody seems to be tending to the light. And you see all these things where they're together and drunk. And I was thinking, okay, how come the light is still on? Like, nobody seems to be working the light at this point. So it kind of seems to be taking a life of its own, while the two other characters are stuck in the house, kind of losing it, basically.
Yeah, totally. And the light in the film, it kind of takes on this kind of really ambivalent relationship between the two characters, where Willem Dafoe is looking up at it and viewing it almost as his wife.
Yes.
Or some kind of like intense emotional sort of pseudo-sexual relationship. Mm-hmm. And Winslow, the young thing coming in, is desperate to gain access to the light. And Wake is refusing him that access. But it kind of looks down on them through this sort of Promethean imagery that comes in later on, and kind of turns to them. And, you know, there's a sense that it may not be a benevolent light.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely. Despite the intensity of that relationship between the two of them, it's the third character. It's the thing that's getting in the way in many ways.
And the thing is that there's something like that's very Oedipian in that relationship. It's like you have this father and son duo where the son is trying to get kind of to the mother, which is the light that Dafoe is really protecting, and he's going to have to kill the father to reach the light. And he's going to pay for it, basically. Like the light is this, you know, forbidden fruit, basically.
Yeah, and what kind of comes out of that is like such intense violence and sort of like hallucinatory horror in the second half, having had this very measured and controlled sort of linear time in the first half. It just kind of transforms into this chaos. Something that's really interesting, kind of going back to the theme of time for a second, is the idea that despite this being a coastal narrative and being surrounded by the ocean, time stops working despite the regularity of things like, you know, the tide and the wind, things which ordinarily men working on the sea would have a really good expectation of. I'm interested in kind of that idea that this film takes a lot of really typical narratives of what we might think of as benevolent or predictable things and turns the good back into bad things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, like, for example, the lighthouse, which is supposed to guide people, is not guiding anybody. And I found it very interesting that there's actually no time where a boat is even mentioned. So it's not even like helping anybody on the sea, because there seems to be nobody on the sea, because we're just in this claustrophobic space and the whole story is centered on this lighthouse. So not only is it helping nobody at sea, but it's also not helping anybody on land. So this lighthouse is guiding no one, or if anything, it's guiding these two characters to their death, basically. And then if you think the mermaid, who is supposed to be like the savior and trying to stay away from humans, she's turned into a siren, you know, because she has that, she shrieks all the time and she screams. So she's kind of, and she's the temptress, definitely, for Pattinson. So kind of all these symbols that are supposed to be helping or guiding these men are actually kind of sending them to their doom.
Absolutely. And it is that kind of sense that the island on which the lighthouse is and the house in which they're living, it kind of becomes this purgatory, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, repeated actions which somehow are still divorced from linear time, and the sense that no matter how long they wait, no one is coming for them. And these actions are in many senses futile actions, aren't they?
Yeah, there's no redemption in the end. Even though Thomas mentions God a lot, but and then Pattinson says he's a God-fearing man, yet they do things that would be questionable for Christianity. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, to say the least. I mean, spoilers ahead, but you know, there's these sort of themes of really murder and bestiality and sort of, you know, what they refer to in the old parlance as self-abuse. You know, there's a sense that they're kind of being corrupted by the island or being corrupted by the lighthouse itself.
And it's interesting because what I've seen in those lighthouse narratives is that there's usually a likeness between being in the lighthouse and being in solitary confinement. And when you think about it, like, so in some of the narratives that I've seen, either they've been murderers before, or they become murderers, or there's also some characters that indulge in necrophilia with drowned women bodies. But in this story, it's very interesting because they're both murderers, basically. So this lighthouse becomes their solitary confinement, basically. They're kind of, they try to, so for Defoe, he kind of, it's understood that he kind of abandons his wife and children. So he's kind of this image of the bad husband, bad father. And for 19th century, these were very strong values. So he's kind of cast in this lighthouse. And to make things worse, he murders one of his young lighthouse keepers. And then it's understood that Ephraim kind of, if he didn't kill his co-worker, he actually kind of didn't help him, didn't save him. So there's something to me, at least in these narratives and in this movie, about the lighthouse as punishment, as solitary confinement.
Yeah, and they're sort of, they really are kind of imprisoned together in a way. It's treated as, they have this kind of like quite humorous false dignity, both of them. They both behave as if they have something really wonderful that life owes them, which they have somehow been denied. And I think that in terms of the relationship between the two of them, they're kind of like mirror images of each other. And it's funny to me because in the dialogue between them, they express so much hate and sort of vitriol for one another. But they're both sort of reflecting aspects of the same idea, that this grandiosity paired with this really like low down, filthy characterization.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's something that Eggers could have done with the name, because we learn that they're both Thomases, which, you know, the real story he was inspired by to write the story. These two guys were named Thomases. Thomas. So I think like he could have really played on that, because these two guys are really mirrors of each other. Probably Defoe sees himself as a young lad and Pattinson hates the old guy because he knows he's going to end up like him. So I think this hatred is for, you know, wasted lives that they recognize in each other. And they're really, you know, I said father and son duo, it's definitely that. These are doubles, these are mirrors, and they are just going, you know, in the same direction, and they're incapable of helping themselves and each other. And actually the old guy is kind of a perverting father figure, because he's the one encouraging his, you know, metaphorical son to drink, and you know, he's the one opening the door for all this vice, but also like the madness also.
And there's definitely that kind of like, as you say, that sort of Oedipal power struggle. I think Robert Eggers is quoted as saying about this film, nothing good happens when two men are alone in a giant phallus.
And it's so true. Very true.
Something that we say on this podcast a lot about film and about Robert Eggers specifically is that it is vibes heavy content, which essentially means that you know, he really obsessively crafts and brings in all these components of like historical materiality to ground the film and make it feel immersive. Mm-hmm. And yes, that was an intentional watery pun, because there is a great deal of immersion in this film. So it's something that was really interesting to me when I was reading interviews with Eggers and figuring out the kind of process, was that he actually built the entire set of the lighthouse from scratch. So the lighthouse keeper's hut and the lighthouse itself, all of that set was built from scratch rather than being used as a setting point. And I thought that that was really fascinating, because there's this idea that this is a classic construction. But with the advent of GPS, lighthouses are hardly used anymore. And there's only really a few working ones still in circulation. So the idea that in order to actually attain an authentic lighthouse structure, you have to build it from scratch within modernity is sort of like an interesting contradiction. And I feel like maybe it says some things about like culturally how we perceive lighthouses now.
Well, I thought it was interesting because I read that they found that the inside of a lighthouse would have been too constricting to do the movie. But I think that is exactly what he should have done. I mean, the lighthouses that I read about, you know, in the French novels, it's usually a lighthouse standing straight in the middle of the sea. There's no land, there's no house. Like, you do everything in this lighthouse. And when the movie started, I was like, oh, that's, you know, missed opportunity. I just thought it would have been so cool to have just the lighthouse standing in the middle of the sea, because a lot of them are like that, and it would have added that element of, you know, added claustrophobia. But yeah, it's amazing that they chose to rebuild all of the set with the lighthouse and the little house. It's just incredible. And it's too bad that they had to destroy everything afterwards.
Yeah, I know. It's this kind of idea of like, you know, you're so obsessed with historical accuracy that you actually like build and destroy something within the same window of time.
Yeah. I wonder what lighthouse he used as a model. Like, I wonder if he had something in mind, you know, or he just had a lighthouse in mind. I wonder if he was thinking of a particular lighthouse.
It's fascinating because it seems like the kind of referentiality of the way this film was put together, it draws from so many different source texts. And something that I found really interesting in the process of sort of prepping to record the episode is that everyone I spoke to about it said, oh, Robert Eggers was clearly referencing this lighthouse, or he was clearly referencing that lighthouse. And we know something about his process, which is that he draws from multiple source texts to kind of construct both the imagery of the film and the dialogue as well. So the ones that he quoted in the sort of epilogue to the film, if you like, was Herman Melville, of course, Lighthouse Keeper's Journals, and the works of Sarah Orne Jewett, who was a regional dialect scholar and a novelist. But he also talks about drawing on this sort of early 20s and 30s French film lighthouse genre. So I'm interested too in your sort of perspective as a French scholar, whether there's any differences between this sort of very American main lighthouse and that kind of culture and the lighthouses you encounter in your work.
I think they're really basically the same. Like you have those lighthouses that are based on small islands, and then those really solitary lighthouses that just stand alone in the ocean. So I think they're really, you know, really similar, and the way of life that he described in the movie, it's really realistically what I've read about, you know, life in French houses. So lighthouses, not French houses, lighthouses. So I think on both sides of the ocean is really the same kind of solitary life with the ocean. Just, oh, and that's what I loved about the movie. The constant sound of the wind, the constant sound of the waves. You know, that is something you find in all those novels. Like, it's as if you can't even think because there's no quiet time. Even though it's in the middle of nature, it's such a... it's a nature that's so alive, like kind of takes on a life of its own. And the fact that he added the foghorn in the movie, I love this. Like the sound is so ominous. And I just thought it was very interesting, though. The foghorn does not always sound the same. Sometimes, especially at the beginning of the movie and then darker moments, it's very deep. And there are a few moments in the movie where it's more high-pitched. So I don't know, I mean, I don't know anything about foghorns, but I wonder why there was a difference in the sound and what it was supposed to convey. I didn't really cue into like a different tone or a different setting, but I thought it was interesting that he would vary with the foghorn in the movie.
Foghorn enthusiasts amongst our audience, sound off. Do foghorns mean different things depending on tone and pitch? Yeah, I completely agree with you. And anyone who's listened to me go on and on about film for any length of time will know I am the hugest fan of score, sound arts, and Foley.
Yeah.
And I have this soapbox about the use of sound in historical drama, about how it can immerse us in worlds which technically no longer exist.
Yeah.
And I think that the work which... the sound was doing, and the foghorn specifically was doing within the film, it was doing exactly that. So shout out to Damien Volpe, who was the sound designer, and Mark Corvin, who designed the score, because not only was that there that sort of maddening, immersive, completely sensory evocation of wind and ocean and mechanical foghorn, but the sound arts and the score blend together so beautifully. So you have these long tones of the foghorn, and then they mix with the ominous score.
Yeah.
And it just totally immerses you both in the backdrop and the environment that these two characters are living in, but also in the sort of like ominous emotional tension. And I think that that's such a crucial idea to this film, isn't it?
Yeah. And it starts really from the very beginning, before even seeing the lighthouse. Like you have this sound, and you know you're on the boat with these two guys and going on a journey where there's no return, basically. So you feel like, I love, like from the very beginning, you just on that boat and it's a one-way trip, basically.
Yeah, there's like a really, really interesting sort of idea of like Chiron and the River Styx, isn't there? That they come out on this tugboat and you see them looking like characteristically miserable and dead-eyed.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of idea that they are, in many ways, they're going to their deaths. Yeah, that's so true. That's really, really interesting to think about.
You know what's interesting also is when they pass by the other two lighthouse keepers that are leaving, no word and no eye gaze is exchanged. So it's like machines or robots walking to work and not even like having this human contact. So I thought it was very interesting because they don't even exchange anything when those other two guys have been on the lighthouse for 4 weeks and, you know, no exchange of, you know, good luck or anything, not even a look, you know. And it's interesting. You see how these men are in their own minds, basically, and there's no human connection or link between them.
I was going to say ships that pass in the night, but I think that might be a bit too punny even for me. Perhaps it might be more accurate to say that they're sort of ghosts of themselves or something.
Yeah,
like
definitely.
That.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. One of my absolute favorite shots in the film is near the beginning, where Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe are just staring directly into the camera. Isn't it so amazing?
It is so uncomfortable.
It is so uncomfortable. And to me, what it really sort of calls to mind was this sort of imagery of like the 19th century photograph and particularly
yes,
those kind of like work studies or ethnographic studies of the photograph, which take people who really would be rather doing anything else with their day than be photographed and captures their image in this really arresting way. There's a lot of talk online and in interviews with Eggers specifically about the film aspect ratio for this movie,
which was a
119 to 1 ratio, which is the sort of the silent film ratio. And technologically, again, the obsessive researcher Eggers uses these techniques of film, 1912 camera lens, a 1930s camera lens, and an orthochromatic filter, which, if I have my technology right, and I'm sure someone will correct me if I don't, is intended to mimic 1870s film by being blue sensitive, which causes the blue to read as white and the color red, which we see a lot of in this film, to read as black.
Yeah.
And it creates these like oily, inky depths, which to me, they're sort of redolent of like the daguerreotype photograph and these really black on white images that are so deep and tight and contrasting. But there's something about that which kind of like sets up the whole idea of this film is like these are doomed characters in a way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think like that's, I love that, like the that scene that you mentioned that looks like a photograph. To me, like I visualize a 19th century postcard, you know, frozen in time. And that's the last visual we have of sane men, basically, is as they enter. And then you end the film with that negative, you know, like the appearance of Patterson is the kind of a photo negative. So it's kind of the other side of the coin where, you know, he's basically walk through the onto the other side into madness, basically. So you open the movie with that 19th century beautiful photograph or postcard of these two men who still have their sane minds. And then you end up with the negative of Patterson like screaming in the night and completely delirious.
Yes, covered in oil, but somehow illuminated to this like insane level of brightness by him kind of collapsing into the lamp, which sort of like eats his soul. Yeah, absolutely. That imagery is like so intense, and I think it's a real love letter to the kind of the Weimar cinema and that kind of like early 20th century, more sinister, more experimental in a way, form of film. I believe I read somewhere that the concept for The Lighthouse actually predated Eggers' earlier film, which was The Witch.
And yes,
I think this in a way is like his weird period. You know, he's had his big success and he has this chance to make something that is completely surreal and
mm-hmm.
and off-piste
and relatable at the same time, like, you know, with the isolation leads to you know, pain and not necessarily madness, but we can kind of relate to that anguish of these two guys stuck on this rock, not knowing when they'll be rescued. So there's something very human in these men that are kind of inhuman or inhumane at the end of the movie. But at first, I think, like, to the midpoint of the movie, we're like, I think we can relate to that really, you know, terrible anxiety of saying, okay, because like the night before, they're like, okay, tomorrow morning we're saved, and then nobody's coming to save them. And it's just, that's when, you know, their illusions are shattered, and that's when things spiral. So I would think that the later part of the movie is a little less relatable, because then it goes into all kinds of their weird things. But at the same time, like, you know, we can relate to some form of anguish at this point.
Absolutely.
So even though it's like a different place, different time, it has some humanity we can relate to.
Yeah, and I think that idea of sort of humanity collapsing under the force of like that solitude and that isolation is a really interesting idea. Given the reception of this film, which was very mixed, it got a lot of critical acclaim, mm-hmm. but a lot of audience, I think, were puzzled by that second act because it is so destabilizing and there's so little clarity. Like, there really isn't a core monster or a core villain, which is something that most people need to sort of conceive of something as a horror.
Mm-hmm.
And there are these supernatural elements and these sort of like almost surrealist elements where there's the possible intrusion of Poseidon.
Mm,
there
yeah,
is
yeah.
an evil mermaid. There is a tentacled creature, which may or may not be Willem Dafoe's character, like in a transformative state. And for me, I think, like, I love the ambiguity of that because it is so unclear whether these are expressions of the two men's personal demons or if, you know, this darkness that is within both of them is somehow finding vent
mm-hmm.
in their surroundings and in this ocean that's coming to them.
I didn't think about it this way, honestly, because I have to say I was kind of not a huge fan of the whole supernatural elements, especially the ending. I'm not a huge fan of the ending, but I like that. I like to think of those things in terms of their own demons that they're facing and that they're imagining. Kind of. So if we think of the two Thomases as doubles, then we also have them as a double character. And actually, Pattinson sees himself actually at one point in the movie when he...
Yes, he sees himself. He turns his own body over and
mm-hmm.
he is wearing his other self, as it were, is dressed in the clothes of the man who he ambiguously killed or allowed to die.
Yeah,
his identity he's stolen. So he's like having this encounter with himself and his own misdeeds.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. So there are definitely different ideas of doubles. And I kind of like this idea of those supernatural, to me, actually, those supernatural creatures are just bred for them from their sick minds anyway. But I like the fact that it could be just what they envision themselves to have become, basically, those kind of demonic creatures that make no sense.
I think when you compare this film to The Witch, for example, which was lauded very aggressively as being a feminist film and a film about interrogating women's characters, this is like such an overtly masculine film.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for starters, like the two core characters are you know, two men, and they have their sort of waiting for Godot moment, waiting for something that's never coming, and sort of interrogating their own manhood within that. The only woman who really shows up is not really a woman at all. She is a creature, a figment, possibly, and a monster. So I don't know, do you think that, like, are there some statements about, like, manhood within that, or would that be taking it too far?
The way I see it is that these two men, since they have no way to kind of express those urges, or they don't have the possibility to go to land and maybe meet women, kind of find other ways to kind of exert those, you know, sexual urges. And what strikes me is that the very first thing Pattinson does when he sits on the bed is to find that sculpture of the mermaid. So it's kind of like right away he gets there, he already finds something that will help him, you know, kind of, you know, live this solitary sexual life, basically. And then Defoe has the light. It's just, so I think they each have like a feminine, what's the word, like substitute. So they're not living without women, they're living with a substitute. So I think the feminine is very present. And also in Pattinson, like his obsession with a mermaid is really, you know, consistent throughout the movie. And then at the end, when he breaks the statue, he says something like, I'm free from the temptation, or something like that. I forgot what he says exactly, but that shows that this is part of their obsession of these two guys, the fact that they don't have women in the lighthouse. So I think women are very present in this movie.
Yes, present by their absence in a way.
Exactly.
And yeah, I definitely, like, I was picking up on the sort of, like, there is almost a homoeroticism to it, I felt like. Yeah. But it's present in the way that they're both fighting it so aggressively. And, you know, there's this scene of sort of voyeurism where Robert Pattinson is looking down at Willem Dafoe's sleeping body, and he kind of, he has his unpleasant and very unsexy, like, buttocks on show through the flap of his overalls. Yeah. And it's this kind of moment of, like, he's, you know, Robert Pattinson is literally a peeping Tom, because he's secretly Tom, and he's, you know, watching it. And he has this, like, moment of disgust, but the framing is very much in terms of desire. And they also have this moment where they're slow dancing together and holding each other so tenderly and so sort of sweetly, almost. And then their faces come up to meet each other, and you think, is this going to become romantic? And then they just start punching each other.
Yeah, I think, like, that's the thing. Like, it's like there's an over-masculine reaction. Like, violence is their way of coping with that moment of tenderness that they don't allow themselves, where they don't allow themselves to go. And I think, like, throughout the movie, this relationship with these two guys is that when you think 19th century, the family is the model. So you have these two bachelors who have to make house, basically, to play, you know, somebody has to cook and somebody has to clean the house. And, you know, there's not the traditional woman in the house, so these guys have to do it. So at one point, Pattinson said, you know, I'm nobody's housewife, but in the end, you know, he cleans, the other one cooks. So they are this kind of couple, but not really romantic with each other. But they do form a sort of couple, like, not necessarily husband and wife in the more traditional sense of, you know, 19th century term. But there is a relationship of, I don't know, complementarity. They form a household somehow, and I think they just don't allow themselves to go further than just, you know, cooking and cleaning and, you know, that kind of distribution of roles, but I think they are just on the verge. But again, because they are seeking and missing the absence of a woman. And so they are trying to find a substitute, and the light and the sculpture are good, but they kind of want something maybe more real. But the only thing more real is another guy, and they kind of are resisting that.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And to me, absolutely one of the funniest lines in the film is when Willem Dafoe so tenderly and with so much hurt in his heart says, "You're fond of me lobster, aren't you?"
Yeah. Yeah. "Tell me you like my cooking." it's a couple's quarrel. Like Dafoe is mad because Pattinson tells him he doesn't like his cooking. So it's just such a, like, a typical, you know, couple's quarrel.
Yeah, the lover's tiff.
Exactly.
And it is, I think, in that way, it's like a really nuanced portrayal of the sorts of relationships that must have sprung up in these very close and tight environments. You know, there are elements of comedy in this film. Mm-hmm. There's human absurdity there, which makes a really wonderful foil to these very aggrandized characters with a huge sense of their own importance and their sort of almost godlike mastery of this life. Yeah. To see them farting, to hear them telling each other, "You smell of shit."
Yes.
You know, it's a tremendously enjoyable relief. To me, I mean, some people find that breaks the fourth wall when they're, you know, engaging this tension. But I actually find it ramps the tension up, doesn't it?
And it's funny because for me, it's really symbolic of the animalization of these two characters. Like, you don't care that you're going to fart. You don't care that you're going to not wash and smell like crap. So I think, like, this whole degenerescence of these characters is really obvious through these things where basically nobody cares anymore. And so they are just becoming beasts, you know, and, well, machines, and just nothing matters.
Yeah. The sea is kind of eroding their identity. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, as it washes up against the rock, as it, you know, destroys the whitewashing on the lighthouse, it's sort of like wearing away those facets of identity. And we get two characters who came in with very, very constructed senses of their own identity. For Robert Pattinson, it's because he has assumed a false identity and he has to keep up the ruse. For Willem Dafoe, it's because he has this you know, intense sense of self, which is tied to his role as a seagoing man, as a Wiki. Mm-hmm. And in different ways, they kind of, like, all those identity markers fall apart, don't they?
Yeah. Everything is destroyed. Yeah. You spill the beans. I love this. Like, you spill the beans. Like, there's no more secret.
It's such
here.
A perfect line. Mm-hmm. Why'd you spill your beans, Tommy?
Yeah.
And again, something quite homoerotic about that, I feel like.
It's funny for me, I feel like then they cannot escape alive because they know something bad about each other. They have to die. They cannot leave the island because they can tell on each other. Mm. So it's kind of like a murderous thing.
It emerges out of this frantic attempt to connect as human beings, and they're drunk in each other's arms, and Robert Pattinson tells Willem Dafoe, can I trust you, I want to trust you, and then he says, oh wait, I don't trust you at all. Yes.
Yeah, and we don't trust them either. We see Pattinson being chased with by Dafoe, who's carrying an axe, and then Dafoe tells us, no, it was the other thing, the other way around. So we're like, all right, so we saw one thing, Tofu is telling us the other thing. So we can trust either of these characters, and we can even trust this movie we're watching, because he's not showing us the truth. Like, he's showing us sometimes the truth, sometimes the hallucination. So at this point, I think everybody's confused and nobody can trust anybody. The
That's
big
so
mirror.
True. It's a brilliant sort of like collapsing of all that historical accuracy that we were talking about, that obsessive mm-hmm. attention to detail, that obsession with returning to records as a means of gathering dialogue, mm-hmm. all of those sort of like aspects of things. It then takes them and flips them around. It turns them into something evil in a way, because it says all of these things that we had, which were the primacy of our knowledge, they've stopped working. I think another really great example of that is in the first act, Willem Dafoe's logbook is such a crucial part of the story, because he is keeping meticulous notes about his second's progress in the hopes that Robert Pattinson can get a job. And then once everything collapses and the lighthouse keeper's house falls apart and the rhythms of the day completely collapse, you just see the logbook floating by, and it has gone from something that is so crucial to the conflict between the two men to this like incidental artifact.
Where there are lies as well. So you can't even trust that logbook. Like, he was like so intent on, you know, writing everything as precisely as they happened, but realize he's just writing lies as well.
Yeah,
or is he? We don't know. We don't even know, because maybe what we saw is not what the reality was. But
and isn't that just so true to the experience of looking at documents from history, looking at fictions from history? It's, you know, a potent reminder of the importance of historiography, I think.
Yeah, the perspective is everything, and it's biased always.
Absolutely.
And when thinking about, I was just thinking of, you were mentioning like the attention to detail. For me, the seagull with one eye mirroring the head in the lobster trap that has one eye is just, I love it. The fact that it's, you know, this whole myth or legend that seagulls have the, or embody the spirit of those sailors that died. Well, the guy that Dafoe killed, you know, is in that seagull that keeps bothering Pattinson to the point where he kills it. So it's just, I love this detail. It's like, I was watching the movie, I was like, hang on, does that seagull only have an eye? And then it makes so much sense when we see the head of the guy in the lobster trap. So it's just, there are all these little details that I think are fascinating.
And in the final shot as well, you have Robert Pattinson's naked seagull eaten form, and the seagull is pecking out his eye.
Mm-hmm,
so
exactly.
The ocean going birds are getting their revenge.
Yes.
I feel like if you were to, you know, watch this movie 5 times, you would find so many through lines like that. And it's just a reflection of the crafting that goes into it, I think.
Definitely. Yeah, attention to details. I was just thinking, like, how do you interpret the last scene? To me, I see Pattinson as, so we hear this crackling sound. To me, his hand is just burning in the light. So there is that, like, to me, I see that he's lost his mind so much that he's putting his hand in the light, not realizing he's burning himself. And then he dies falling down the stairs. But it's so interesting because I watch with subtitles because the accent is so strong. Sometimes I did not understand everything. And it, at one point it says he's screaming, but then it says something like, I don't know, like laughing or something. And I feel like, I don't think this final scene is pleasurable to him. I think it's just like a madman burning his hand and then just falling backwards in the stairs.
I think it's very much open to interpretation, as you say.
Yeah.
The way I read it I think it's kind of a combination of the laugh and the scream. I think mm-hmm. he has become so obsessed, monomaniacal about gaining access to the light at all costs, that he kind of can't differentiate between pleasure and pain anymore.
Yeah.
And there is that component that he is covered in oil and reaching into a lit lamp. So on some level, there's kind of the aspect of, you know, being physically burned. But I feel like for me, the more important idea was that, you know, he was burning from within. This was like an emotional form of destruction. And it kind of plays with that Promethean imagery, the idea of like a mythological character who steals light from the gods and then is rewarded by having his guts picked out by, I think it's eagles in the Prometheus story, but it's seagulls in the lighthouse.
He adapted it. But then does that make Defoe the god?
That's so interesting. Because again, it plays with these dynamics between them. I think at some levels, Defoe's character thinks he is the god. He is the god of the wick.
Of the lighthouse.
The lighthouse. Yeah. But at the end of the day, you know, he is murdered by the young man, and he is given like the ultimate disrespect. He is not given a sea burial. He's put in the earth, and he is covered up. The opposite of what his wishes would be. So it kind of like disempowers the character. There's a lot of layers and ambiguities to the ending.
So many. Like, I watched it for the second time yesterday, and I was like, oh my god, I was stopping every minute, every 2 minutes to take notes and write things that I was observing that I had not seen, honestly, the first time I saw it. It was just, it's incredible. So many layers.
I 100% agree. So my other question for you was, given your research specialisms, for those of us who have fallen in love with 19th century lighthouse horror and coastal gothic storytelling, are there any other texts or films that we should check out to expand our knowledge of this world?
Oh, there are so many great texts, but then, unfortunately, they're all in French and they have not been translated. So I think I should start my translation business and get to it, because so there's one in particular I've been working on. It's called The Tower of Love, and it's by Rachilde, a woman, and it was written in 1899, and it's just a fantastic story of these two lighthouse keepers stuck in the lighthouse, and the old guy is a necrophile, and he kind of fishes the bodies of female after shipwrecks, and he saved the head of the first drowned female body he found, and it's locked in a closet in the lighthouse. And then the younger one still is kind of a romantic and kind of hopes to get married and, you know, not end him like the old guy, but then he eventually commits a murder when he goes to land. So he comes back to the lighthouse, decides never to set foot on land again. So these two men basically are just stuck in the lighthouse and doomed to become madmen together, and it's just a fantastic story. That's why when I saw the severed head in the movie, I was like, do something more with it. Save it somewhere, like, you know.
And there is that necrophile aspect to the film as well. I think, like, there's the initial encounter with the mermaid. The first time I saw it, I thought, that's a drowned woman. This is going to become a necrophilia story. It turns into this sea creature, this monster instead, and it sort of goes down a different route of monstrosity. But that sounds like such a phenomenal novel. And like, it's amazing to me that, like, in so many ways, an original 19th century source text can surpass 21st yes. century film adaptation in terms yeah. of like sheer gore and violence and horror. Like that's a really fascinating, like it shows something about like the cultural perception of those lighthouses and like how people were preoccupied with them in different ways.
Yeah. And what I find in those stories is the female element is also very important. So in this story, it's like, you know, the amount of necrophilia, the murdering of women because they can't love us. They're betraying us. So we have to, you know, lock them up or kill them. And then there's another story by Anatole Lebras, and it's the Guardian of the Fire. It's a similar story, but this time it's not a bachelor. The guy is married, but he realizes his wife cheated on him. And so he finds a way to get both of them in the lighthouse and seals them in one of the rooms of the lighthouse. So to me, these two stories are must reads if you like lighthouse horror and like masculine anxiety that translates into, you know, imprisoning women so that they don't betray.
That sounds truly fascinating. And I think for me and a whole range of our audience as well, you've just opened up a whole new world of lighthouse horror that I'm excited to get engaged with.
I'm actually excited to read his sources because I haven't read his sources. So I kind of want to see, you know, what he used for the movie. So that opened also a new area of research for me.
Absolutely. And I think the full range of all the lighthouse texts which he looked at would be like a really interesting study yeah. in their own right. Yeah. Because it just seems like it was so referential and mm-hmm. so enmeshed in not just the sort of like empirical source evidence, but also like the novelistic culture. It seems like for that time period, the novel and the kind of documentary writing style went so much hand in hand.
Yeah. And I would love to be able to ask him if he has heard of any of those French texts, because there are definitely some elements that I find in his movie. So maybe one day.
Absolutely. Well, Celine, thank you so much for coming on Historical Friction.
Thank you.
Where can we find you on the internet? And do you have any books or anything you would like to plug?
I have a book, but it's also in French, and it's called Le Taureau Triste, the Sad Bull, and it's on Solitude and Madness in Maupassant, who is a French author of the end of the 19th century, and it's on the Solitude and Madness of his bachelor character and his stories.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. Before we go, I also want to give a quick plug to the Haunted Shores Research Network, who were tremendously helpful with helping me prep for this episode. And you can find them on Twitter and online and all that good stuff. Thank you so much for coming on today, Celine.
Thank you. I had so much fun.
You're fond of me, lobster. Say it. Say it.